The Guardian.
Parliament reconvenes as we've never seen it before. I'm Jonathan Friedland, Guardian columnist, and this is Politics Weekly.
The ability to hold the government to account, the ability to seek redress of grievance, the ability to take up those matters brought to us by our constituents so that they may be put right, is best done when this House sits.
As we record, Prime Minister's Questions is set to look very different to the last such session, which took place a very long 3 weeks ago. No actual Prime Minister present for one thing, as Boris Johnson continues to recover from COVID-19. Fresh faces, including a new party leader in Keir Starmer, sitting on the opposition front bench. And the majority of MPs popping up on screens around the House of Commons as Parliament goes virtual. There are some worries about whether these proceedings will be effective. We all know how stilted Zoom meetings can be, not to mention the potential for technical breakdowns. At such a critical point in the nation's history, how will this temporary setup affect Parliament's ability to hold power to account? This week also sees Boris Johnson resume limited prime ministerial duties. But after a Sunday Times investigation raised serious questions about his action and lack of action in the first phase of the coronavirus crisis, we ask what the future looks like for Johnson's leadership. Plus, as the world stares down the barrel of a global recession, or perhaps even a depression, The Guardian's economics editor, Larry Elliott, examines the possibility for economic reform when the pandemic is over. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, for anyone who's counting, this is the fifth week of lockdown in the UK. Many of us are making the shift to working from home, learning the intricacies of various technologies that help us stay connected to colleagues. On a grander scale, technology is making history this week as MPs returned to the House of Commons. Well, at least some of them did. Today, members of Parliament embark on the first ever virtual PMQs after an extended Easter break. At least 120 MPs were aiming to be seen on screens around the House of Commons as they connected via video link. To discuss how the lack of physical bodies might impact parliamentary proceedings and more, I'm joined by The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor. Kate, very good to have you on. It's another historic week as Parliament goes virtual. And as we record, they're preparing for the first ever Prime Minister's Questions using this new method. But there was a bit of a trial run, and we hear it didn't go too well.
That's right. I think MPs were finding it quite difficult, especially in terms of online voting, which seems to have been very difficult. There's been a description of it as being, you know, a real cock-up, basically. The app crashed. Lots of people didn't get text messages to let them know that it was their time to vote. A third of people couldn't vote at all. So I think yesterday was a real kind of trial run, and it is complicated for people. And all of these things take time and they add to delay. And I think it probably would have been quite stressful for the MPs who weren't able to participate yesterday.
And Politico reporting that this was just a trial of some 30 MPs. So you can imagine what it's going to be like when we go for the full 650. Nevertheless, there are people who are a bit optimistic about this, thinking that just like many people who've been working from home for weeks, hold on a minute, maybe this is something we could do after the lockdown. And there was a piece from the SNP MP Angus McNeil, who's, I think, the greatest distance from Westminster out there in the Outer Hebrides, who has a 1,000-mile round trip to get to the House of Commons, saying, why can't I do this all the time? These new procedures, they're definitely temporary, right, Kate?
They are temporary, but I just think that if they can work well and if they're effective, then why not introduce them? Parliament is often criticised for being very, very behind the curve and sticking to its rules and regulations. We've seen it with pregnant MPs and proxy voting. And there was such a fight to try and get proxy voting introduced. And eventually, after decades, that was able to go through. But I think what's going to happen is if the technology works well, then I think the strength of the argument will be very clear to see that a lot of Parliament, in some circumstances, can be done remotely. And I know that people will want to be there in person. And it's only really right that, you know, for the functioning of democracy, that people are there and people are walking through the voting lobbies. But if the technology can work, then of course, someone who has a seat in the Scottish Islands might be able to, if it's convenient for them, every now and then vote in a different way or participate in a different way without spending all the money, taxpayers' money, effectively on their travels down to London.
In 1349, when the Black Death affected this country, Parliament couldn't sit and didn't. The session was cancelled. Thanks to modern technology, even I have moved on from 1349, and I'm glad to say...
Now, the Leader of the House, Jacob Rees-Mogg, who everyone knows is a stickler for doing things the old-fashioned way, has imposed a strict dress code, even if you're dialing in virtually. I mean, presumably not white tie and tails, but what is the dress code? And are people, I mean, I imagine MPs are really getting anxious about the sort of visual background that they're going to be showing their colleagues who are suddenly getting a through the keyhole moment looking at their houses and flats.
No, I mean, you're so right. In some ways, it'll feel like a huge invasion of privacy, and there'll be a lot of concern about, you know, is my background correct? Or some people might be hastily arranging books on shelves to make them look extremely intelligent. We've already seen MPs with children. It can be difficult to make sure that they don't enter the room when they're asking questions. Jacob Rees-Mogg, though, has said the dress code needs to be as if you were coming to Parliament. So you need to be smart. You need to wear what you would normally be wearing if you were going into the chamber. And that applies for the bottom half as well. So
you just anticipated my exact question. I mean, because I was going to say they could be, it could be shirt and tie for men above the waist, but, you know, boxer shorts below, surely.
Well, I think MPs are just going to do exactly what they want. But the suggestion was, please, please, please dress completely, put your trousers on and make sure that you are as presentable as you would normally be if you were going in person.
Now, the key, obviously, the real function of these sessions, whether it's questions to the Prime Minister or urgent questions or acts of scrutiny in the House of Commons, that it is serious business about holding the government to account. And defenders of Parliament always say it's the cut and thrust of that human debate that is central to how parliamentary scrutiny happens. What's the sort of worry that you're picking up from people about the kind of stiffness and rigidity, and everyone who's been working from home and going, having meetings via Zoom will know what I mean, you know, whether that's going to be what effect that has on how Parliament does its real business, which is holding power to account?
Because it's going to be stilted. You can't avoid that. There'll be a minor delay and you won't have that very quick back and forth that you would have if you were there in person. And you're also not going to be able to get the energy and get riled up from colleagues. So I'm just thinking, you know, the noise at PMQs is often a big indication on how people are feeling about the government. And for many years, the silence of the Conservative backbench has been very telling, particularly in the Theresa May era, of how they were feeling about the relationship between the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister. So because you're not going to see that en masse, you're going to lose that atmosphere and you're going to lose those visual cues which show you how the parties are operating and how people are feeling. And it's the same for Labour. We had very glum Labour backbenchers who were not cheering and were not supporting Jeremy Corbyn. So those kind of things are the visual cues that journalists use, and you're not going to see much of that anymore.
And ordinarily, we would, if this was a normal PMQs, we wouldn't be talking about the sort of forum and the means. We would be focusing 100% on the debutante today, which is a new leader of the opposition in the form of Keir Starmer. And historically, people have always said it's very often that very first PMQs where you make a first impression that can last. What's your sense of how Keir Starmer, will have prepared for today?
I think he'll have been preparing for weeks, if not months, waiting for this moment. He's very forensic. He's used to speaking in this way. And I think that is the tone he's going to strike today. But like I said, he's not going to have the support, that noisy, rowdy support. I just think because it's been such a big shift in the Labour Party, and because so many people are talking about this being a new start, a new era, I think that it will be a miss for him to not have that I think he would be expecting to have in normal situation.
Yeah. And on the other side, he'll face not the Prime Minister, but Dominic Raab, who, as you say, is and has been deputising for Boris Johnson. I mean, the burden on him is going to be quite heavy because I suppose there's real questions about the government's credibility now, just literally whether you can trust what they say, especially after what we saw unfolded yesterday, Tuesday, with this constantly changing story on what has become one of the central issues during the coronavirus, and that is the failure to procure sufficient protective personal equipment, PPE, for frontline health staff. And we got this change in the story yesterday with whether or not it was a government decision not to join the EU procurement scheme or whether it was just sort of a technical failure to get the email, you know, from Brussels saying there was this scheme. Raab is really going to be on the hook for that, isn't he?
Absolutely. Yesterday was a really shambolic day. Whether or not we have chosen to deliberately ignore various EU schemes and try to forge our own path foolishly or not when it comes to procuring various essential items to fight coronavirus, I think that's going to be a huge focus. And these questions are constantly being put forward to ministers, people like Dominic Raab and Matt Hancock, people who are very, very visible, people that do the daily press conferences. And often I think, you know, it's not entirely their area. It might not be their exact brief. And they're having to field questions often on decisions that they may or may not have been part of. But I think we might just see things battered away purely because the full detail isn't known yet and they can't give the full answers that the public are expecting.
That was The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor. Now, in the past few years, the very idea of globalisation and international free trade has come under increasing pressure. Competition to be the world's economic top dog has become more pronounced, and China and the US have been locked in an on-and-off trade war. And then the COVID-19 outbreak shook the world and its economy to its very core. Experts aren't questioning whether or not we'll end up in a recession. The only debate is how deep this recession will be and whether it will develop into a full-blown depression. Unemployment is expected to rise exponentially, and governments are scrambling to find ways to lessen the pain. So what, if anything, has the coronavirus outbreak taught us about our collective fragility economically? And will it force those in power to recalibrate the entire economic system when we make it out to the other side? The Guardian's economics editor, Larry Elliott, spoke with Diane Coyle, who's Bennett Professor of Public Policy at the University of Cambridge, and who also runs the Enlightened Economist blog.
This, I think, is the biggest crisis I've experienced in my lifetime. Just thinking about it in pure economic terms, it's going to be worse for the UK than the Great Depression, I think. We think of the Great Depression as something absolutely terrible. It was actually much worse in the United States than here in the UK. And if you look at the forecasts, any reputable forecaster, the OBR or the National Institute, have put out for the impact of this on the economy, it's going to be worse than the Great Depression here.
So do you think this crisis is going to be a prolonged one? Because I hear your comparison with the Great Depression. I mean, one of the features of the UK economy in the interwar period was that we had quite a tough 1920s as well. One reason that the Great Depression wasn't as bad here as it was in some other countries was that we'd already had it pretty bad in the 20s. I mean, there is some hope that this might be over fairly quickly, so it would be short and sharp and nasty, but over quite quickly. You seem to be saying that you think it could go on for quite a bit, with quite a lot of scarring.
I don't think anybody really knows at the moment, because clearly it depends on whether there are second waves and so on. So it's really impossible to tell at the moment. If we could get back very quickly, then there might be a short, sharp bounce back. But the way that everything is so interconnected makes that less likely the longer it is before we get on with all of those things that make up the fabric of the economy. You know, the local services that aren't happening anymore, the small businesses that are going under. So all of that will, you know, be torpedoed if this continues for very much longer. And that's why I'm kind of pessimistic about it. So it's not just the global supply chains, it's all of that sort of the thickets of economic activity that make up everyday life.
Isn't what makes this so unusual compared to other crises is that actually dealing with the first part of the crisis, the health crisis, makes the economic crisis worse. Whereas in the past, take 2008-09, there was a problem with the banks. Governments, central banks knew what they had to do in order to put the banking system right. And once they'd done that, then it was pretty much back into recovery mode. This time, dealing with the health crisis is actually making the economic crisis a lot more difficult to solve.
I'm very uncomfortable in portraying this as a trade-off between sorting out the health problem and sorting out the economy, because people think about the economy as being, you know, money, and it looks like that's a very unappealing trade-off between life and money. And that's not the case at all. You know, this pandemic is what's damaging the economy. And when we talk about the economy, we're meaning people's lives. It's about the things that mean that they can earn money to pay the rent and buy food, and that we know from all the well-being research give people meaning in life. But you're right to say that there's just no escaping damage. There's no clear path out of this that will not cause economic harm one way or another. What we're talking about in terms of policy is trying to minimise the amount of harm that occurs. And if you like, when it occurs and how long lasting the effects are going to be. I get quite impatient with people who say, our government is definitely doing this wrong and another government is definitely doing this right, because I certainly think our government's doing things wrong, but nobody knows the right answer to this. And in fact, there is no easy answer to this crisis. It's just going to be a hit on our livelihoods.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point about governments. They seem just to be trying things, which from an economist's point of view is not a bad idea, is it? You try things, if they don't work, you try something else. That's surely going to be better than just sitting there and allowing the crisis to unfold without doing anything at all. I mean, you know, it's obvious that things are not going to work perfectly given the speed at which this is happening and the pressure on governments, policymakers to respond. It's a bit unreasonable to expect them to get things 100% right all the time.
I do absolutely agree. It's not just experimenting, it's that there isn't the information that enables people to get policy right the first time, even if they were able to pick out exactly the right thing to do. So we've got to allow them to experiment and expect that they will get things wrong. Having said that, the way that these things are getting communicated, it's been a very non-transparent conversation, I think, and that really hasn't helped trust.
Yeah. One of the things that's changed during the course of our working life is that economies have become a lot more global. I mean, there's always been an international dimension to economies, but say in the last 30 years, the spread of the global marketplace has become a lot more obvious and supply chains have become much more complex. How much do you think the actual structure of the global economy has led to this crisis? Has it been a factor? Has globalization been a factor in leading to this crisis?
You're very good about reminding us how old we are.
Experience is the word I would use.
This trend towards globalisation has obviously been going on since, you know, the deregulation of financial markets in the 1980s and the trade reforms that reduced trade barriers. And there have been great things about that. It's enabled the biggest reduction in global poverty the world has seen by India and China entering those global markets. It's meant that consumers on low incomes in Western economies have been able to access things for much less money than they would previously have cost them. So there have been good things about it. It's been a driver of productivity and economic growth. But as we are now seeing, it creates vulnerabilities as well. They've been obvious before, you know, earthquakes or the Japanese tsunami pointed up the vulnerabilities in these very extended global supply chains, and we're seeing that now. So I'm sure one of the outcomes of the pandemic will be a rethink about how much global integration of that kind do we want. I don't think it will all get undone, but there was already among economists, I think, a trend towards agreeing with the need to keep more know-how and engineering and manufacturing capability in the Western economies, not just because of the impact on jobs, you know, the so-called China shock, taking out steady manufacturing jobs, but also the ability for reasons of retaining skills and know-how and these kind of security reasons, keeping some of that in the home economy. So there's definitely already starting to be a rethink about that, and that's building on a trend that we saw before the pandemic.
Going back to the original point about the Great Depression, crises in the past have led to a rethink of economics, not just the 30s, but 1970s crisis too. That led to the sort of free market revolution of the 70s and 80s. The Great Depression led to a complete rethink of how economies were organized. Do you think there is the possibility that this crisis will throw up some new thinking about economics?
I'd say it's a probability more than a possibility. And building on trends in thinking about economics that are already underway and have been underway since, I'd say, even before the financial crisis. The high watermark of what people refer to as neoliberalism, you know, the rational decision-making, free markets, the best kind of economics, was actually a very long time ago. Subsequently, economics has become much more applied. And I would say certainly for the past 10 years, there has been a much greater willingness among the mainstream, the leading departments, to think about economics in a different way. So I think the crisis is definitely going to accelerate a move toward thinking about how the relation between private sector, the state, and other kinds of organisations, collective organisations, ought to work together to shape the economy.
Do you think that the crisis will lead to a greater focus on what's known as happiness economics, the idea that we're going to focus more around climate change and dealing with other big crises that are out there, along with health pandemics? Do you see that as a possibility?
I wouldn't say it's so much about measuring happiness as thinking deeply, as occurred after the 1920s and 1930s, about what is the aim of economic policy? You know, what is the metric of whether things are getting better or not? What do we mean by economic welfare, by things getting better for people? Clearly, GDP doesn't do it, and it's had lots of flaws that people have pointed out for a very long time. It still matters. You know, GDP, as we were discussing earlier, is people having jobs and income to buy their food and pay their rent. So it's not that it's unimportant, but lots of other things matter as well. What is it that you can measure that really gets to whether people can lead the kind of lives they want to? This is what Marchesen, the Nobel Prize winner, refers to as capabilities. And I think of that as measuring the assets that people have access to. Do they have access to good public infrastructure, to clean air and green spaces that we are rediscovering really important for people's mental health and well-being? Obviously, do they have access to money as well? But what kind of community, what kind of social capital do they have? What kind of skills and talents have their education and training given? What kind of human capital? So that's another approach. How does that mesh into the economic theory? Because when you get the events, like a crisis driving change, and you get some kind of consensus about what you ought to measure, and you get some kind of analytical underpinnings, then you have the lineup that can bring about a really fundamental change in how we think about the economy.
The Guardian's Larry Elliott and Bennett Professor of Public Policy at the University of Cambridge, Diane Coyle. After the break, I look at what the Prime Minister needs to do in order to take back control of the government narrative. We'll be right back.
The Guardian Science Weekly podcast is exploring some of the crucial scientific questions surrounding COVID-19. From soap...
It does not matter how good your soap is, it is how you apply it on your hands.
...to social distancing...
The fact that we're doing this online means I'm unlikely to spread an infectious disease to you.
...to unlocking a lockdown.
If you ease off when your infections are still at a very high level, you're just going to maintain infections.
Listen to Science Weekly from The Guardian on Apple, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. On Tuesday, we learned that Boris Johnson called President Trump to discuss coronavirus matters and that he's due to have a telephone audience with the Queen later this week. Both are signs that he's starting to resume some of his duties as Prime Minister. But it's expected to be a little while yet before he's back at full strength. So what will he be coming back to? At the weekend, an investigation by the Sunday Times disclosed that back when Johnson was fighting fit, he had missed 5 consecutive COBRA emergency meetings in the first phase of the coronavirus crisis. Many are now questioning whether this revelation, that the Prime Minister was fatefully slow to consider the potential for a national disaster, will damage his standing and credibility now. And who can he look to in his cabinet to shoulder some of the burden? To discuss all this, I spoke earlier in the week to The Atlantic's Tom McTague and to Katie Balls of The Spectator. Well, for the last few weeks, there's been a whole lot of goodwill messages directed at Boris Johnson, and those reached a great intensity when he was moved into intensive care. And I wonder how much that led to a certain period where people felt reluctant to criticise him, perhaps thinking it would look in bad taste to criticise him. And then on Sunday came this piece in the Sunday Times by the Insight team, which really has made the weather in the Times since, many people discussing it. Do you think that marks, let's start with you, Katie, a kind of end of the unofficial moratorium there had been until that point on criticising Boris Johnson?
To a degree, I think that when Boris Johnson first went into intensive care, there was such a level of shock, actually also within Downing Street, but particularly, you know, in terms of everyone who would normally criticise the Prime Minister, that it did seem as though things were being put on pause. We didn't have that same level of perhaps scrutiny on some of the decisions. Everyone was willing to cut the government some slack. I do think that has been easing off, though, ever since he left intensive care and it became clear that he was in a stable condition. It did feel as though briefly politics was on pause in the normal sense and partisan politics had moved away. But I think there was always a limit to how long that could ever really last.
But I think to some extent, he will always have some political immunity from here on in as we go through what happened and what he is going to do from this position. People will not be able to say that he doesn't understand it or he hasn't got an insight into what it's like for people. So, and those would have been quite significant attacks on a Conservative Prime Minister overseeing a healthcare crisis. So I think to some extent he has political immunity, but only to a certain extent. This is a national crisis that everyone is feeling and everyone is concerned. And the concern is that he didn't take it seriously enough himself before he was ill.
As you're saying, the Sunday Times thing does mark, does it, a sense not just that the media are saying that now the right to ask tough questions is there, but do you get the sense that that's true, Tom, also of the public, that actually now it is legitimate to wonder if, for all the personal struggles he had, the national struggle against this illness has been, in some ways been made more difficult because of decisions he made, meetings he literally didn't go to?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I think we're also seeing just the fact of time playing out here. And at the start, you're feeling forward in the fog almost. You can't see what's happening. You can't understand what's happening. The data isn't in yet to show how other countries are doing compared to you, whether that's Germany or France or Spain or Italy. And you're slightly behind, so there's this lag effect. But I think we're also seeing this idea of Johnson and who is Johnson as a leader being tested. Now, he's often likened, or he likens himself, or his cheerleaders do, to Churchill. That's sort of something we've come across. But the thing with Churchill is he gained his prominence in that period, and he rose to the top because he had the foresight about a problem that came to the surface. In this instance, nobody can claim Boris Johnson has some kind of foresight that this was going to be a bigger problem than it turned out to be. The criticism is the complete opposite, and that's his real Achilles heel here.
You've also written, Tom, in The Atlantic, that Boris Johnson leads a government that made little sense without him, was your phrase. And I wonder, Katie, to the extent to which what we're talking about now, we'd be talking about anyway, because a prime minister in our system is so important, but whether there's a particular intensity around this question, simply because this government is one in which Johnson looms so large. It is, to such a great extent, so much about him.
One of the things I keep hearing from ministers and Conservative MPs is that Boris Johnson was crucial, not just to decisions, but also just to the general communication strategy. And I do think that one of the things they really feel they are lacking right now is at these press conferences, having a politician, you know, with that level of cut through. And it just really does show that this is not a particularly well-experienced cabinet in comparison to previous ones. And I think that when we get to this exit strategy debate, we know that no one in Number 10 wants to talk about an exit strategy. Ministers are very reluctant to get into it for a number of reasons. But I also think one of the reasons they are reluctant is there's a sense that it is going to be so painful working out some way back to a form of normality that you're going to need very clear communications. Now, you can say Boris Johnson is not a clear communicator in the sense that he can go to various places in a sentence and sometimes the message does get mumbled, but ultimately, he is a much clearer communicator in the sense that people will listen to him in a way that I think it's unlikely they're going to listen to Alex Sharma. And that means that there's another effect in how we're not able to move forward in some of the things that the government would be doing if the Prime Minister was in Downing Street right now.
You are right. I think fundamentally that there is a real truth to that. And the person who is obviously not a sort of junior minister or junior cabinet minister is Michael Gove, and he's not deputy prime minister. And I think that's telling in itself. But I think it does speak to this dominance that Boris Johnson has over the Conservative Party, over our politics in general at the moment. And this is a facet of his career, actually. It's something where he has never bound himself to a clique or a faction within the Conservative Party or within any organization. He's always sought to dominate on his own terms. And actually, the story of Boris Johnson's life is that he's always succeeded in that, right the way from Eton through Oxford to the London mayoralty, and now as Prime Minister. When he's had to play a bit part, he's not played it very well. You know, there are some people who know him. I think Charles Moore talks about Boris Johnson not being able to do any other job other than being Prime Minister, because he has to be the captain of the team. And this is his challenge when he comes back, I think. He has to come back and set out what it is that he is trying to achieve other than Brexit. Because what has happened is we have been exposed to the fact that we don't know what this government is there to do other than to take us out of the European Union. What is Johnsonism? What is the country that he is trying to create at the end of this? And that is, I think, why the exit strategy is quite difficult, because that effectively is what it is. It's a way out of this and to build something new, build something that is positive. And we just don't know, do we, that is his government liberal, populist, libertarian? Is it big state, small state, effective state? We don't really know these questions because each of his ministers carry something completely different. Priti Patel and Michael Gove are very different people.
Although right now, maybe they would just be delighted just to get out of this and not even yet worry about what country comes afterwards. But Katie, let's talk to you about what happens when the Prime Minister does come back and what he's coming back to. It doesn't look great, even before you'd read the Sunday Times account. You've got Matt Hancock. It seems to be on track to fail that crucial promise to carry out 100,000 tests a day by the end of the month. The rate doesn't seem to be heading in that direction. You've still got, and they're getting louder, those complaints from NHS staff and managers that they do not have the adequate personal protective equipment, deliveries that are promised that don't arrive, and the numbers of people dying are still extremely high. How on earth does he take back control, to use that very storied phrase, in such a dire situation?
Yeah, I mean, he's coming back to several headaches. Also, he's coming back to a situation where, in a way, not that much has changed since he's left. What we are seeing is they are trying to tackle the day-to-day running of government. We see the issues with PPE, but there is no one trying to really bring those competing agendas together, bring things forward. So when Boris Johnson comes back, he needs to weave together these various competing briefs, because what's been lacking, I think, in having Dominic Raab in place is how he's managed to get by is by not overstepping. It's been described to me as a more of a caretaker manager than a decision maker. So I think that when Boris Johnson does eventually come back, there are lots of important decisions that have to be taken. And if you look at the 5-point plan that Dominic Raab laid out, which is how you get to an exit strategy, ultimately, it doesn't really say that much. The first three, which are about figures, are quite easy to answer. But 4 and 5, if you look at it on testing PPE and avoiding a second peak, it's hard to see currently how you answer those about an effective PPE and testing strategy. And I think that at the current rate we are going on those two issues, you don't quite get to the point of having an exit strategy yet. So I think he's going to have to start making difficult decisions, which at the moment no one in the cabinet wants to make, partly because they don't want to overstep and also because they're decisions which will have losers.
And Tom, one thing that I think probably all his colleagues could agree on that they desperately want back is Boris Johnson's optimism, positivity, his cheer up message, keep calm and carry on, but also just somehow have a smile on your face despite everything. Do you think that is, you know, if you're reading the room, as it were, is that what Britain is yearning for, do you think? Is that something that's going to be welcome when he comes back, or is he going to have to almost play against type?
Yeah, I thought his video that he recorded on release from hospital was actually really interesting in this regard.
We are now making progress in this incredible national battle against coronavirus. A fight we never picked against an enemy we still don't entirely understand.
I think he came across quite vulnerable and melancholic, but very emotional, actually. And it wasn't the clown that we've seen before. It was playing to something else. He is an emotionally intelligent politician. He can read the room to some extent, and he has been able to adapt to various different scenarios. He is able to adapt. So I think he is going to have to offer both an optimistic view of where this country is going to get to, where he wants to take it, but also, as you allude to, a sense of seriousness that this hasn't been handled perfectly.
I mean, Katie, this is you're a Boris Johnson watcher, like, more closely than most. I mean, is it your sense that he will come out of this experience in which his life was hanging in the balance, a changed man in terms of, yes, his leadership and how he conducts himself as Prime Minister, but even his outlook more broadly, politically and on life?
Potentially. I do think, though, what a crisis can do is hurry change that was already going to happen. And I think on some of the things that this is going to lead to in the Tory party, these are things that were slowly in the works to begin with. I mean, the Tory party on the NHS has been moving from a line where they would question the model, talk about reform, to treating it as though it is a national religion. We saw that in the general election. It was one of the first times the Tories actually wanted to talk about the NHS in an election. That was a Dominic Cummings strategy, and it worked. I think that the Prime Minister has had this personal experience in an NHS hospital means that message will become more potent, and it is going. You're going to see the Tories probably put even more money in the NHS than they were planning to. And it was already the one thing where I think they were not going to even talk about reforming it in the way that they are looking at other institutions. He will be changed to a degree, but I also think some of the things we're going to hear from Boris Johnson are close to things he was saying a few months ago. It's just it's harder to knock him down now.
Tom, it's odd in some ways to talk about the politics of this while we're still in it. But first, do you have the sense that there are people in Downing Street thinking, what does this government and this Prime Minister have to do to ensure that come 2024 in the next election, how do we make sure that this government isn't saddled with blame for how this thing is handled forever, going forward for the next 4 or 5 years?
I think it's a real risk for them because the numbers won't lie to some extent. You know, if the UK is an outlier in Europe or globally because of its death rate, that is a fundamental political problem for the government that they will have to wear, and they'll be wearing it against a very effective leader of the opposition now, who is himself a more plausible alternative prime minister. So it is a weakness. And the only way that they can really deal with that fundamentally is to ensure that they're not an outlier in this. So they're having to take seriously the lockdown for longer, perhaps, than they would ordinarily perhaps want to think about it. So I think that is something. But you are also going to see people inside Number 10, as you mentioned, people like Dominic Cummings, who will presumably think that this justifies a lot of what they've been saying about the vulnerability of the state to deal with crises that it can't forecast. He, you know, his essential philosophy is that the state isn't up to the challenges that it's now facing in the 21st century. And he wants to completely remake Whitehall. Now, you can completely see how Boris Johnson could come back and that project was put on, you know, turbocharge. There is a potential for this to be extremely radical.
It's a fascinating question whether afterwards actually the public mood will be desperately for just stability and quiet rather than yet more radical upheaval and disruption. Katie Balls, Tom McTague, thank you both. There'll be a link to Katie and Tom's work on this episode description on the Guardian website. But that's all from us this week. Now, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but once again, I just want to thank all of you who've supported The Guardian so far. Trusted news is more important than ever as we all navigate these tough times. The Guardian's committed to accurate, reliable news in all our reporting, and you can help us provide the quality information the world needs by supporting us. Just head to theguardian.com/supportpodcasts. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Kate Proctor, Larry Elliott, Tom McTague, Katie Balls, and Diane Coyle. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please do take care of yourselves, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.